What's that, George? Oh, yes, my
What?
t-shirt. My t-shirt. Yes, I got
All
this at a
right.
very nice. Hey, yes. Where did I buy this? We can get this lovely t-shirt located here.
Or here.
Insert.
Yeah. You
Insert
gotta give a better
video ad.
look with just seeing the top of it. Or you gotta back it up. Back it up.
Video
Oh.
ad. So you say you're gonna be working on some new designs then?
I
Yeah,
am,
right,
yeah.
George?
I'll make some new designs for us.
Ooh, don't tell us though. Don't tell us. Don't tell. I don't wanna know. I just wanna see it. It'll be nice and exciting. Is it gonna be movie related or like writing?
So like how like these play with our logo with different known typography. It'll be
Yeah.
something like that. Yeah.
Nice. I'm excited.
It'll be in a genre that we all love very much.
I'm not gonna make any guesses because I don't want our listeners to know and get any hints on it, but
1600s period pieces.
I
Damn
don't
it,
know. You
Jose.
figured it out. Non-dialogue foreign films from the 1930s.
It's just gonna be in a
Fun.
box, and it's like suspenseful.
If you made those and those things outsell all of our other t-shirts, I'm gonna be offended.
Now I feel like I gotta do one.
Suspenseful music. That's all it says in boxes.
People look at it
Suspenseful
just like,
music.
I've
I
been
hear you,
waiting for Dan.
this all my life. Someone
Writing
finally
notes.
did it. I'm telling you, man, that would be, I would actually probably buy the t-shirt. Suspenseful. Because you know it's like a conversation starter. We're gonna ask you
Yeah.
about it.
What
And on the
color is that
back thing,
shirt? Oldie timey beige.
oldie-timey bay. There you go. That's why we wear all of our t-shirts. We don't do logos anymore. All we do is just play off the mood of whatever emotion we're trying to emote at that
Yeah.
particular emotion.
How are you feeling today? VHS. Just feeling VHS. It's a sticker.
Feeling
The
very
sticker.
VHS.
VHS.
That's it. Very VHS today. So, on that note, welcome back to Not a Strong Start, a podcast by filmmakers who talk movies, television, and emote through our t-shirts. I'm your host, the Inquisitor.
I am not your host. I want answers, damn it. I almost thought you were going to say, I want answers, damn it.
I know. That's what I thought too. I was like, damn.
Well, I'm your other guy, the man with all the answers.
That's right. So, in this week's episode, we're going to do something kind of fun on this one. So, I have a series of questions to ask you guys. It's going to be more of like an open conversation, open debate. We're going to have a lot of conversation going on with this, but you guys don't know what any of the questions are. So, that's the fun part. Do we have a current event?
The current event is that there is no current event for this one.
There you
We're
go.
changing it
Boom.
up for this one episode. It's a special episode.
There
And
you
with
go.
that being said, I've
Nice.
got the first answer for you. And the first answer is you go sock, sock, shoe, shoe. You don't go sock, shoe, sock, shoe.
Who
So there you
does
go.
what
Yeah. There's your first psychopaths
step. That's what I'm saying, man. Like I
are there?
it's enough for people to actually talk about this. Like this is a known
Yeah.
question. Like who it's also like the people that do milk and then the
That's what I was going to
cereal. Like
say.
who
It's
does
up there with
that?
that. Yeah.
What the fuck is wrong with you?
Oh man. Yeah, I'll never See, because I like
understand
to drown my cereal. That's how I work it out.
Yeah, seriously, man. I blame people in Delaware. It's got to be people in Delaware that are the ones that wear the
The
sock shoe,
forgotten
sock
state
shoe.
that no one cares
The
about.
forgotten
Yeah.
state. Yeah, exactly. Sorry for you Delawareans that are listening to us today. You could buy your t-shirts at the Nas Thrift Store.
Be Delaware about that. Be
Just be Delaware about that. Exactly.
Delaware.
All right. So you guys want to have some fun with the with these questions?
Let's go, bro.
Okay.
Let's do it.
All right. So here's the first question we're gonna do. Is Tom Cruise a more successful actor than Tom Hanks? That's all I'm gonna say. Is Tom Hanks or is Tom Cruise a more successful actor than Tom Hanks?
I
So,
wonder if we're gonna be the same all right. because on three, let's just say yes or no, Jose. I think we're gonna be the same for some reason. Okay. One, two, three. No. Yes. Oh shit. Oh shit.
The great debate. Yes. All right.
It would go away because I feel it's a layered question. You Yeah. know, it depends on the context of it. I say yes if we're looking at financial success of career. I think that definitely goes to Tom Cruise. He's had bigger financial bangers and all that stuff. So that's the way I'm looking at it when I say
Okay.
yes, box office success. And I think between the Mission Impossible franchise with with like Top Gun and the last one that came out, like I feel his movies have been more bang for the buck when we've gotten with Tom Hanks, even though I think Tom Hanks is a more talented actor. I think Tom Cruise as a whole has found more success.
It's because of how you phrased your question. You said who is the more successful actor, correct?
Yeah.
Okay. I see Tom Cruise as a superstar. He's a superstar A-list actor. Not saying he's not a bad actor. Tom Cruise is one of my favorite actors. Mm-hmm. He's like top tier for me. But the reality is that Tom Hanks is the actor's actor. Like, he's multiple award-winning actor. While Tom Cruise has been nominated, Tom Hanks does the winning. You know, so that's why it was when you said that, I was like, wait, what? It's like, he's the actor. When you think of someone who's like an actor, it's Tom Hanks, you know? And Tom Hanks has done a little bit of everything too. Not that Tom Cruise hasn't, but Tom Hanks has done a little bit of everything and it's been successful at all of it. There's a rare time when you could think of a Tom Hanks film where he was necessarily bad or it was necessarily bad. While Tom Cruise, as much as I hate to say it, has had some like flyby flops. You know, you think of him like Valkyrie. No one knows about Valkyrie. People forget about that movie. A movie where he does a good acting job, like Lambs for Lions. Anyway, it's like no one talks about it. It kind of just went under, you know? It's like he doesn't have that acting appeal that Tom Hanks has. He has the superstar appeal where it's like, you know, he's going to give you something bombastic and over the top because he does things that are physical and, you know, death defying, which is not necessarily 100% when you think of an actor. Mm-hmm. So, yeah. Good question, little.
Thank you. That's what I told you. We're going to start on this first. We're going to start off with a banger. And here's where you can argue both cases as well, right? Because we know Tom Hanks is the 2-time Oscar winner, right? Like, he's won it. Tom Cruise hasn't. But then you also have Tom Hanks, in terms of box office success, has also done the Toy Story movies, right? So, like, that counts part of his repertoire. Yeah. But at the same time, Tom Cruise has been doing this. Like, it feels... I don't want to say Tom Hanks has necessarily dropped off, but he's not bringing in the same type of... He can't carry a movie like he once has. And Tom Cruise still is. So it really depends on how you rate this and how you go with
the Mummy,
all
though.
Stuff.
The Mummy, though?
I know.
The Mummy? Day and Night, though? Day and Night?
But you know what? Like, Tom Hanks has had some duds, too. He had the one where he was the old man or whatever. He's grounded.
The name Otto. A man named Otto.
The Da Vinci Code.
Yeah, like he's had some duds too.
They're both older now. Yeah, they're both older now. That's the thing.
Yeah. So but they started, I think they started like
the same
4 years apart.
Yeah.
With Tom Hanks started like 4 years before. But I feel like Dan's saying Tom Hanks is kind of slowly sort of going, while Tom Hanks has kept it kind of ramped up overall. So I think he probably will still go beyond Tom Hanks. If you're looking at ability, it's going to be Tom Hanks performance-wise. He's had more successful performances. But they're both actors.
Yes.
And overall success.
Great success.
It's got to be Tom Cruise. And when you have the volume that Tom Cruise has, you're going to get some duds in there. And I believe his volume is higher than Tom Hanks's volume.
Next question for you guys. Okay. Which actress will be the next Meryl Streep? Of the actresses that we know. And of course, you can't be like, well, no one's going to quite hit the same level. Which one's going to be closest to her that we're going to walk away saying, okay, from the generation that we've seen, she's going to be the most successful actress, however you categorize that, as the closest thing to Meryl Streep that we've seen?
Man.
So it would be talent-wise, as well as the you know, the accolades that come with that. Correct?
There's two that come to mind, but with that criteria that you gave.
Mm-hmm.
So I'm gonna pull a Dan, Anna, Jose, and cheat, and so I'm gonna say it's gonna be.
Answering questions, Dan, Jose, cheat when answering questions.
So it's a toss up between Jennifer Lawrence and Emma Stone.
Mm.
Now, that doesn't mean that I'm a fan necessarily of all of their work. I'm just going by what's on paper.
Yeah.
You know, so you look at their career path and their trajectory, both are multi-Oscar winners, at this point. They both have been a part of big franchises, and I think they're very transformative at this point with some of their stuff, especially Emma Stone. You know, if you've watched Poor Things as of late, like, that, quite a film. Oh my God. So, you know, I think they're on that path. I would have originally said Anne Hathaway because she has the demeanor of a Meryl Streep, but no accolades, not the accolades to back it up like the other two do. So those would be my choices. I think they're on that path to being at Meryl Streep status, especially Emma Stone.
And here's the thing to keep in mind. Meryl Streep is known as the, obviously, the Meryl Streep of, you know, actresses.
Yeah.
But it's not like she was necessarily headlining movies that was like this box office smash. Like, she was making all this amazing money at the box office, although she had movies that made very well for themselves. Yeah. I'm not discrediting that. She's known as Meryl Streep because she just dominated the spectrum of like the acting and the accolades and being nominated and all this stuff.
Yeah.
There's one in mind that comes to me, but I don't want to say it if Jose's gonna.
There's Jose still, yeah.
You know what? I'm gonna go with someone who isn't there yet, but I can see the potential of them being there. You know, they're young, so they still have plenty of time. Maybe like a Anya Taylor-Joy at this point.
Mm-hmm.
That the talent. Has had some popular movies out there that people have picked up, has done a wide range of movies. I feel is respected for her talent. You know, she's still very young, so she still has a chance to kind of reach up there as she continues to do projects. So I'm gonna throw her out there.
Yeah, I like her. Yeah.
Yeah.
She's definitely proven that she's the best part of every movie she's in.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and that's a key too, is that they have to show the ability to be able to lead a movie.
Yeah.
Right? Because Meryl Streep clearly can. They have to show the ability, and Anya is just being able to show that now, or at least given the opportunities, she's starting to lead the movies. Here's one as well. You guys had great answers. Florence Pugh. I feel like she's
I thought of her. I thought of her.
Her acting is, you know she's going to get an Oscar under her belt. You know she's going to get an Oscar under her belt. And I felt like she's kind of like that Emma Stone rival. A little bit right now, because Emma Stone's the one that's getting that love. You know, she's two-time now. She's a two-time Oscar-winning actress. Jennifer Lawrence, I felt like, was on that path, but for some reason kind of, like, stepped back a little bit or something. I'm not really sure what it is.
She got oversaturated for a bit.
She did. Yeah. And she smartly took a step back, but I felt like she needs to jump back into it again.
Well, she became a mom, but, you know, having a kid can do that
exactly,
too.
Yeah. But man, Florence Pugh, though, I think is just her.
That's a great response. Yeah.
She dominates.
And people love her. That's another thing. Having people like you.
Yes.
Like, people
you have
like
to.
Her.
That's the Meryl Streep effect, right? You have to be liked. You can't have a lot of haters out there that are arguing.
Yeah.
You have some people that Anne Hathaway is one that's polarizing.
That's why I didn't put her. I didn't
very
put her
polarizing.
Because she has the demeanor, but people don't like her for some reason.
I feel like with Emma Stone, I feel like she's liked by a lot.
Yeah.
But she's not as well-rounded, like well-liked, I should say, as quite like what we mentioned. Jennifer Lawrence seemed very well-liked until she got overly saturated, I felt like.
So, I mean, similar thing happened with Emma Stone. She also had to take a break.
Yeah.
She was kind of getting oversaturated.
Yeah.
And this is kind of her coming back now, just like Jennifer Lawrence is coming back now.
Yeah, absolutely. All right. You guys ready for the next question? Do you guys like these questions so far? Right?
Yeah.
It's good.
Okay. All right. Who's delivered the better acting performance so far? Jason Momoa or Batista?
Oh,
Batista.
Dave Batista, right?
Batista. Yeah, okay. Yeah.
So let's go a little bit into that, like, why, right?
Yeah.
Well, I mean, like, he's putting in the work, it feels like. Like, as for, like, becoming an actor, I feel like he's trying. Like, you see him trying to do different things with each part he does. You know, he's not just the strong guy anymore. He used to be the big guy in the background who's going to punch you and throw you around. Like, now he's talking. Like, he's giving you dialogue that has weight to it. And I'm starting to feel it from him. You know, while Momoa is just the guy who's just like, you know, that's all I feel from Momoa in anything he's in. I don't really, except for maybe C, that show I think it was on Apple, where he plays like a blind, whole blind colony.
Yeah.
I felt a little different there. But at the end of the day, he's still what? A big buff dude leader who's going to like smash things, you know?
Yeah, I gotta go with Batista because he's not only shown more range, he's been successful in that range and providing good performances overall. While Jason Momoa, as entertaining as he is, it's charisma and toughness. Those are the two things for pretty much all his characters. And it just, all it does is the needle goes more towards the charisma or it goes more towards the toughness, but it kind of stays in both of those things. While Batista, you know, we've seen charisma, we've seen toughness, we've seen vulnerability when he's put that out. We've seen his comedic timing has been really good in a bunch of things. So, you know, he has more tools in the shed at this point. So Jason Momoa is closer to what The Rock has been than Batista.
Yeah. I mean, the best example is go to Dune. Watch Dune.
Yeah.
They're both in the same movie, you know? Yeah. And when I watched Momoa in that movie, I feel like I'm still seeing how he was like an Aquaman. Yeah. He's just like that bro-y guy. But Batista, like, you're seeing a fierce predator. You're seeing someone who's vulnerable. You know, like, even though he's a part of this dominant race, he still has like that softness to him where it's just like he doesn't also want to disappoint. You know, there's these levels to him that you get to see that you don't expect. While, like I said, the other guy, he's just a bro who's there to protect you, hopefully.
Yeah. I know the movie wasn't very popular, but he did a great performance in Knock at the Cabin. That character, he acted the shit out of that character who, with his size, still came off as so like vulnerable in there, where you kind of felt for the character.
Yeah,
he was able to elicit that empathy from the audience,
almost like a Lenny of Mice and Men kind of feel.
Yeah.
I think I agree with you guys. It's so weird to see where Batista was with wrestling, because like, who the hell would have predicted this? But one of my best one of my favorite performances from him is in Blade Runner 2049. I love Batista in the little tiny scene that he's in, because you see so much emotion coming out of him in that tiny little brief window that he's in. And when you see stuff, that was a perfect example we mentioned about with Dune, because I hear some people that praise Jason Momoa and was like, oh my God, you know, his acting in that was great. I thought he was good in it, but like, it still feels like Jason Momoa doing his thing. Like, I didn't see a big difference between that, but how Batista is in Dune, he shows a lot of vulnerability in there that I just never expected from this guy. Like, that was my mistake. I didn't know he was capable of that, because we've been so jaded of seeing wrestlers that act, and we've never seen a real wrestler that can really act like this. So with Batista, I'm excited, man. I want to see more of him. I hope he keeps exploring it. I know he is. I'm glad that he's kind of stepping away from the whole Drax thing, because I thought he did great as that role. Like, I loved his character. But I like how he's like, I'm not going to be, you know, subjected to just that. I want to go and become a real actor. Like, props to him for that, you know? So, okay. Here's a fun one. Who had the bigger flop, Steven Spielberg or Martin Scorsese?
I feel that while both are tremendous directors, which is obvious, it got to a point for Spielberg, especially like post-90s and the 2000s, where in general, he had a hard time ending his movies. So all of his movies are really good, but he just, nailing the landing became hard for him, it felt. You know, he's kind of climbed out of it now. He's getting a little better, but that was the problem with him. Well, I feel like Scorsese's been pretty solid for the most part about telling a good cohesive story all the way through. Even with films like Hugo that didn't do so well, you know, you compare Hugo to like BFG. It's like, I'd still pick Hugo probably over that film, you know, but it's hard. But that's probably how I go with it. So it's not so much of a flop as so much it is just like the overall way they're able to convey their stories and the way they attack a story.
So would you say Spielberg had, like, would you say BFG would be his biggest flop then? Is that the movie example you'd use?
I thought that was a good way to compare, because those were equal in what they were and almost around the same time.
And both kind of equally floppy in a certain way.
Yeah. Because they're not movies that you talk about for either creator.
No.
You know, you're talking about things like Jurassic Park and freaking The Departed, you know, stuff like that.
You hope the person you're debating against doesn't bring those up.
Yeah.
Please don't bring up that movie when we're talking about who's a better director.
That's why I established both of them. Not that good.
Yeah.
I'm going to have to go with Spielberg too, but there was two movies that I couldn't decide which one it was going to be. I believe box office, they did okay, but that was just based on name. But I think critically, they were kind of a flop. And even though you have BFG, it's not it's not well known as it is.
Yeah.
I consider these bigger flops because of the properties that they were. And it's a tie for me between The Lost World and Crystal Skull. Two movies that made box office success because of the property and the draw of the property themselves, but critically were not that great and flopped and not up to par with the originals. So that's what I'm going to have to go with that. He seemed, sequels are maybe, in the deal.
That's why it's
that's
so
something
smart.
To think about. That's something to think
that
about.
Scorsese doesn't do sequels because he stays away from that. There's nothing to compare it to, right? But when I had this question, I was thinking, well, The Lost World, because I totally forgot about the Kingdom of the Crystal Skull. And it's like, oh, you're right. But you know which one I didn't really like love? Remember how Scorsese did, what was it, The Irishman, right? Was it The Irishman?
Yeah. That one didn't do so well, no.
No, and it was so like long. Like that's
Wasn't
the thing
that straight
with
for Netflix?
Yeah, yes. But that's the thing with Scorsese is that, but his movie, his budget was like 90 million, I think, or something like that. It was really high, or 100 something
million.
It was a lot.
I think it was
over 120 million. But like the things with Scorsese lately is that he's fallen into a pattern of his movies being almost unnecessarily long.
Yeah.
Like each movie's like 3 hours long. And it's like, dude, it doesn't need to be like that. Like a lot of times, what made Scorsese so great was because it would always be like, he'd say a lot with such little. Sometimes, and I feel like lately sometimes we kind of draw things out, but very hard choice, man. I mean, we're talking about the two goats here of directing. These two guys are the goats, man. Okay, here's a fun one for you guys. Sell me why Austin Butler is going to be the next Leo DiCaprio.
I mean,
I'm not saying
well, you know
talent,
what?
Just...
You know what? So here's something. When Leo first came out, like in the early 90s, I was not a fan. I thought he was horrible. I didn't think he was a good actor. I was like, he's just a pretty boy. Why is everyone gushing over this guy? Then he worked with Steven Spielberg and Catch Me If You Can and Martin Scorsese in Gangs of New York. When he made that pivot and started working with greatness, two guys we just talked about, I saw something. It's like, okay, he needs to be with people who are going to draw it out of him, who are going to pull out that and guide him to what good acting and what a good performance can be. And ever since then,
That's all he's been working with are great actors, great directors.
But I've loved his performances then after that. It's like, oh, wait, he's actually really good now. I love him. Like, and he's doing different things. Like, he's trying out voices. He's trying out different mannerisms and stuff. I think that's what Butler has going for him right now. Like, when he first dropped out in the scene, he was just like that pretty boy face who was doing some shitty TV and some shitty films. No one knew who he was. Then he works with Baz Luhrmann. He's now working with frickin' Denis Villeneuve. And at first we thought it's like, oh, he's just going to be Elvis for the rest of his life. But then you watch him in Dune Part 2. It's like, oh, he can do another voice. He's not stuck with that Southern drawl for the So, yes, he could definitely be on the path for being the next Leonardo DiCaprio, especially if he keeps his off-screen persona as that humble guy that everyone wants to work with.
All right, I'm gonna be honest here.
It was hard, right?
the only movie I think I've seen with Austin Butler in it was Once Upon a Time in Hollywood, and I do not remember him from it. He did not stand out to me.
I'm doing the devil's work.
So I have no clue if he's gonna be the next Leonardo DiCaprio because I have not seen, I don't think I've seen any of his other work. I know who he is. I know he was Elvis. Didn't watch that movie because I don't think I've ever watched an Elvis movie. That has no interest in it at all. And I haven't seen Dune 2 yet. And I know he's in that. So honestly, no clue on this one.
I've watched both those movies. I've watched some of his performances. And I could say, like, it's very transformative. He does a good job in turning into these people.
So I was a fan of Leo earlier in his career than you were, but with Austin Butler, I felt the same way. He came out, I'm like, here's another one. Yeah. Like, we see so many, like, it seems a new Caucasian actor that's blonde, and they're just throwing them in our face. Like, every 3 years is another one. And they keep throwing them in movies. They don't do very well. We keep questioning, why are they still in movies? And then they fade out. Austin Butler was another one that I saw. I'm like, okay, But I think the spin on this one is I'm starting to see some of the talent came out. Like, I thought he was really good in Dune 2. But it's the fact that anytime you get an actor and these great directors are jumping at the opportunity to work with them, that's where you start to hesitate and thinking their career could be a little more promising, right? Like, that's what we start to see there. So the fact that the first movie that I've seen him, you know, pop out was a Tarantino movie. And then people have been seeing the dailies and he's getting booked off of movies for stuff like that. Like, you could probably end up seeing him doing like a Christopher Nolan movie at some point. Like, it seems like great directors are wanting to work with him. That's where I think it's a potential that it can happen there. So, you know, we'll see. The question is going to be, can he lead in like a movie? Like, we know we saw him do it with Elvis, but it wasn't so much him that led it. It was more of like the character that you're playing. Cause if you're making an Elvis movie, Elvis has fans. That's why they went. Here's the question. Can sequels ruin an epic first movie?
Yeah. I mean, no. Here we go. No, it can't.
You going no?
Yeah, I'm going no.
Okay, I'm going to go yes. All right, let's do it.
Here's why. Sequels can't ruin an epic first movie overall, as a whole, because the first movie does not go anywhere. You could still go back to that movie. It is what it is. It can ruin a property or a franchise as a whole, but it can't ruin the first epic movie because it is what it is. You know, you can always just watch that movie and ignore the rest. There is only like one situation I can think of where it can, and that is if it's done as a two-parter. So it's not the first one is a part one and then there's a part two, then yes, because that's one whole thing together. But besides that, there's plenty of properties that I watched the good one and then I just skip the rest until my next watch through and then I go back to it.
So here's why I'm going to say yes, because granted, in my heart of hearts, I'm with you. I just don't watch the shitty films. I've done it with the MCU. There's plenty of MCU films I don't watch. But just to be a contrarian, I'm going to say yes and use the example of The Matrix, because the first one was so freaking good and did things that were so fresh and new while also borrowing from old techniques of like noir films and everything and just combining the old and the new together in such a masterful way that it makes part two and three seem like part one was an anomaly. But like those two, they kind of almost ruin the allure and the mythos of these characters. So when you're watching part one, and if you've seen part two and three, you just have it in the back of your head of like, man, they're going to suck in the future. They're not going to be cool anymore. You know, part four happens, which we didn't even want to talk about, but it happened. And they're going to make part five
is coming.
They're going to make a part five. And it's just like, when you know how cool the characters like Neo and Trinity and Morpheus are, and even Agent Smith, and for it to just be like shit on in the sequels, and you know it's coming. That's the part that sucks. Is in the back of your head, you know it's coming. It's like watching Star Wars, and you love Star Wars. The first trilogy is so good. You know, it's like lightsaber, awesome. But in the back of your head, you know midichlorians are coming. In the back of your head, you know that someone is going to kill Han Solo. It's just like it lingers back there. It's like, oh, so much crap is going to come in the future.
Just like when you eat Taco Bell, you know what's coming.
So much crap is going to come in the future.
So much crap is going to come.
I think that's the part that sucks when you have a bad sequel. It's like it's even though you could just not watch it, it happened and you experienced it, even if it was only once. And you're like, damn it, why'd you have to put that in? I don't want that in there with this good memory. I don't want that. Got to go back to One Flew Over the Cuckoo's Nest. Lobotomy, bam.
There you go. You both bring up really good points, man. Because take Matrix, right? That's literally the only one I go back to and I rewatch, and I do rewatch it. But it's like the thing specifically with Matrix, though, is that the story never actually concluded in the first one. Like, it sets it up where like you kind of have to watch the sequel and the third one, right? When you get something like, let's say like a
Jurassic Park.
Like Jurassic Park. Yeah, it's its own standalone movie that I could just go and watch part one and the other ones don't really have a direct effect. Just like with Star Wars, I know the other ones are out there, but like, I can just go back and just watch the original. Like I'm cool with that. But it's hard to, I hear what you're saying, because like in the back of your mind, I know it's still there, but it still doesn't take away about how like beautiful and great that that first movie could be, right? Just like with Matrix. And like, I use the example of Kill Bill. Kill Bill Volume 2 is great. Like, you know, it's good. It's really good. I just love Part 1 so much. I've seen Part 1 like over 50, 60 times, and I've seen Part 2 like maybe 3 times. Like, I just don't, I just don't go back and rewatch it that much because Part 1 is so amazing. It's so much better. But that kind of, even though there was a continuation where you know she's going to, the first one still kind of closes its doors well enough. You know what I mean? And I felt like with Matrix, it doesn't quite close it all the way because it even ends with like a pun. It ends like a cliffhanger sort of. And like, that's where you don't quite get the conclusion that you need to. So it really is, it's hard.
I got one more piece. I'd like to present item 54-5C over here to the court. You guys got the paperwork.
Objection. He never sent the paperwork to us.
It's check your spam. For further proof that bad sequels can't ruin the original, there's a reason that we have so many times now when a property has been rebooted, reimagined, a new timeline created, where they don't always eliminate everything. They keep the first one and they're like, let's restart after the first one because the first one is that good. If those sequels were to ruin that first one, you're more likely to just wipe all of it out, but they keep the first one. And that's become more common because it's like that first one is so classic and so good.
That's a good idea. Like Halloween did that, right?
I thought of Halloween. Yeah. It's like, no, now we have two different trees of which where more shit happens and it's just more bad memories, Jose. All right. You look at Halloween, there's three branches that were going off here where everything just keeps on going down the crapper.
And that's the tag for this episode. It's him going on that rant, going down the crapper. Why? You have to tell me. You got to find reasons, Jose. You have to find reasons. Why James Gunn has zero doubt that he'll be the DC Messiah? Why is there zero doubt that he's going to do that for the DC movies?
Okay. Why we think or why he has zero doubt?
No. Why you guys have zero doubt that he'll be the DC Messiah?
I mean, you just go by the numbers, right? Just numbers and facts speak louder than anything, right? What movie has he done where it was a bad movie? Like, critically, like he hasn't really done a bad movie critically. And then with each film he does, it does better financially than the last one. I feel that that's a pretty accurate statement. The only one you can probably say otherwise would be like Suicide Squad, during the pandemic. So it's kind of hard to critique that financially as compared to like the Marvel films he did. But he's one of the key components besides Robert Downey Jr. of why the MCU has been so successful. Like the other movies started copying the whole Guardians of the Galaxy dynamic. That's why the first Suicide Squad became what it was because of what he did. And hence why they gave him the reins to do the next one. Like, he's continuously doing better and better with each film he does. So I think his track record kind of speaks for itself.
And you think his skill perfectly captures what DC needs?
I think so, because he's also got a great grasp on characters. You know, and he knows how to develop a character and a story. Being a fan also of comic books itself, I think that plays a good hand in it. Understanding how a film and the business works. Like, he's one of those like jack of all trades that you really need to be behind the camera and be behind all of this stuff so that it gets done correctly. You know, if you have one person leading it, I think it'll work. Their mistake in the past has been like too many chefs in the kitchen. You know, if you work the way the MCU works, which he's already been over there and he knows how they do it, you need a Kevin Feige. You need that one guy who's steering the ship, and he's your one guy. So I think he's got it.
A lot of the points that George made, and then if you look at actually the projects that he's done, if you just narrow it down to comic book property itself, and that would give us, what, four movies? The Guardians of the Galaxy trilogy and the Suicide Squad.
Plus Peacemaker.
And the show Peacemaker. Yeah. That's all, the quality is there. So he shows he understands how to put an entertaining product when it comes to comic book characters. And it's not all surface level. You know, you could tell he's digging through the comics, through those boxes, and pulling out other things, you know, that appeases to the comic book fans. That while the general audience might not catch certain things, the comic book fans like, oh, I know that character. I've heard about that character. And he's able to pull that out. And Guardians of the Galaxy, I feel, is the biggest example. Even as a comic book fan, I tend to lean more towards DC when it comes to reading just because of bandwidth. But I didn't really know about the Guardians of the Galaxy. So when that was coming out, I was like, you know what? I'm not going to read anything. I'm going fresh with these characters. These characters became household names to the general audience, which is one of the hardest things to do. And he did that by handling the characters, handling the story well enough that people found entertainment, and it was both critically and financially successful. So I think the proof is there. There's enough proof there to show, given time, allowing his creative vision to be put out there without interference can be a recipe for success.
That's a good point. And I think with, you know, when we hear Messiah, it's almost like a savior, right? But you think when you... what we've gotten from the DC since like the 80s, going back to Michael Keaton, Batman, like everything's been kind of dark. Everything's been what DC kind of represented, or at least what, you know, we envision as DC, because you have like darker characters, darker storylines. It's like, okay, already, like give us something different. And I think with him, that's exactly what we've gotten. Like you mentioned Peacemaker, the show's been really fun. Like the character himself has been very different than at least what I would envision. And being so interested in that TV show, it's one of the best superhero shows I think we had, especially with the first season. It's been great. So I think it's nice to get a new, it's a way that we can truly get a new taste of Superman. I feel like under him and Batman, it feels like what Superman should have been, but they went very dark with it with Zack Snyder. They went too dark with Superman, because they try to almost emulate what Christopher Nolan did with Batman. That was where they kind of made the mistake. It felt like Superman was somebody else than what he really should have been, because it didn't feel bright enough. I feel like we're going to get that with him. It's not going to feel like it's overshadowingly dark and gloomy, because that's what you guys like with MCU and stuff. It feels like it's going to be fresh.
Yeah, and that's the thing. Like, he knows how to handle the light mm-hmm. side with the dark stuff. You go to Peacemaker, mm-hmm. there's a lot of heavy dark stuff that happens to that. Like, his whole relationship with his dad, that's some effed up stuff,
yeah.
you know?
Yeah.
Like, yeah. It's pretty messed up.
Yeah.
And to pair that with all of just the comedic hijinks that you have going on, his relationship with the bird Eagly, and come on, you need great. That levity to go and juxtapose against all that abuse that he's dealing with his dad and all the violence that's happening.
Mm-hmm.
The last Guardians of the Galaxy, the closing of that trilogy, shit got real dark.
It did.
Shit got real dark to the point where I was like, I don't know if kids should be watching this. Like, mm-hmm. it got really dark, but it's also a funny movie on top of that. That's that good balance, because I also don't want someone coming in there and just being like, dark failed with DC. No more dark. Only jokes. Only lightness. That's it. Because that's overcompensating the other way, and that's also going to set you up for failure. You need a balance. Properties that should be lighter, such as Superman, should be lighter, but still a little bit of seriousness there to raise the stakes, so it's not all jokes. Properties like Batman should lean more towards the darkness and maybe some light levity moments.
Yeah.
So it's about being able to, the whole DC as a whole, switching the meter and the scale, balancing it to fit the character in their world, where you're not just stuck in one tone the entire time, which is one of the big problems with Snyder. It was all very kind of one tone.
You're building a roster for a guarantee Oscar-winning movie. Who's your director? Who's your lead? Who's the love interest? And who's the antagonist? You don't have to pitch what the movie is.
Just who's your cast, pretty much? Who's your crew?
Yeah. Who's your cast and crew, and why? Like, why those people? Why do you think? And this is your Oscar. Like, you're guaranteed. I'm gonna win an Oscar. You're a producer.
So not hit movie.
No, Oscar winning. Like, you want an Oscar winning. Like, you need a guarantee.
Yeah.
You know, like, this is like, I need to win an Oscar. You're an Oscar. You want to be an Oscar winning producer.
All right. I think I got it. I'm just gonna. Okay. I'm setting this up with no story in mind, increasing the chances of an Oscar here. Mm-hmm. So I'm kind of piling it up.
But also think, who do you think would have good chemistry, like on a set? Who would creatively have good chemistry?
Oh, well, I'm going kind of straight talent here.
Okay. Yeah. Yeah.
So I'm there.
Okay.
All right. Director, I'm gonna go Christopher Nolan. You know, fresh off of this Oscar and stuff.
Yeah.
The sky's the limit.
He's pretty good.
He could do something.
So we'll go Christopher Nolan. All right. Then out of retirement, we bring Daniel Day-Lewis in there. All right. Then we're gonna have.
Is he your main actor? Is he your?
Yes.
He's okay.
Yeah. For antagonist, let's go Christopher Waltz. That's the antagonist. You said
who? Oh, Christoph Waltz.
Christoph Waltz.
Yeah, Christoph Waltz.
Okay.
We'll go with him as the antagonist.
Love interest.
You know what? Let's go Kate Blanchett.
Okay. I like that.
Okay, Blanchett. I feel age, appearance wise, she can match up as a love interest. She's got the talent on top of that. So let's throw her. Let's throw her in there. I almost went Meryl Streep, but I'm like, I put Daniel Day-Lewis and her next to each other, and I'm like, I don't see it. Let's go Kate Blanchett.
And then just for shits and giggles, what genre? Like what type of genre do you think you would go with?
For this, okay, we want to push Oscar. So we want to go period piece. We want to go period piece. We want to go drama and something that involves a lot of trauma. Let's increase these chances of the Oscars.
Like Victorian era? You going something like Victorian era? Like something like back then? Like
let's go World War One.
Ooh, okay.
Time frame. Let's go that time frame. You know, I'm trying to think of what appeals to these Oscars. So we need drama, we need trauma, and we need those actors that they automatically look at for Oscars. So we're just gonna load the bowl with everything that's appetizing to it. We're gonna give them the whole charcuterie board that they love.
So it's trauma, drama, and someone's mama. Throw them all in there. Okay, I like it. All right. Okay. What do you got, George?
I like that. That's what I'll say. I knew one of us was gonna pick Christopher Nolan. So
for yours, try not to pick anybody that he picked. So
well, yeah, that's why it was good that I got to listen. So it's like, not writing that name.
Yeah. Okay.
But I had a backup. We've already talked about him. Denis Villeneuve is going to be my director. But I'm adding a caveat to this because I don't think he's always 100% on his script. So I'm going to pair him up with a writer. I'm giving him Noah Baumbach. So he did things like Marriage Story, Barbie with Greta Gerwig. I think he's a tremendous writer. I think paired up with that. And did you mention love interest? I think of him too. I think he's great with dialogue and relationships. So his main star, we have Oscar Isaac. I think he definitely deserves to be within that realm of thinking of when it comes to Oscars. His love interest would be Ana de Armas, just because she's been proving herself to be within that category of actress now. And their antagonist would be Tom Hardy, just because that guy is, to me, like a Daniel Day-Lewis, where he can just transform into anyone you need him to become, you know, and he'll disappear into that role. The first time I saw him was Bronson. I saw him in Bronson. It was the first movie I saw him in. I was like, who is this guy? I need to see more of him. But that's my team. I think that's my team to get an Oscar. They've all either have won or have been nominated at some point or been a part of something nominated. So I think that they're in that realm. Plus, being some people of minorities of sorts, we're in that realm now where you kind of have to have that. The Oscars are saying, like, we have to have at least some films with these people in it, and they've been proven sometimes those people have to get an Oscar to make a point. I think they can make the point while also walking that line of, like, hey, they look kind of white.
Yeah. There you go. I like it.
And I see it being like a kind of a thing. You ever seen the movie The Fountain? With you know the people already, I'm gonna say. I
Rachel
imagine
Weisz.
that kind of story where like it spans through time and space. So that way we can get that picturesque kind of like wide shots that Villeneuve is known for, but we can still get that really good storytelling that Baumbach can get from these actors.
Nice, man. Nice. Good. Those are some good choices, man.
That's yours.
Yeah,
I
right?
didn't even think. Okay. Let's see.
You
So
didn't even
director.
think.
No, I'll just listen to your guys' stories. Okay. So villain, I'd probably go Gary Oldman. I haven't seen Gary
Oh,
Oldman
yeah.
chew on a villain in a while, man. Like, let's get some villain because he was some of my favorite villains that I've seen, and I love him in Leon the Professional. So let's see him as a true villain. Love interest, gotta go with Florence Pugh. Gotta go with Florence Pugh because I think she's that next star. Lead actor. Let's try Christian Bale. Let's try Christian Bale on this one. Director. Who do I want to see? Let's bring Spielberg back into this. Spielberg, we haven't gotten like a good Oscar. Let's get vintage Spielberg to come back and try to give us an Oscar-winning win for this one. You know, he's still got it in him. I know he's still got it in him. Let's get some of that to kind of mix it up a little bit. We can get. Let's make it a sci-fi drama. We'll do something a little different for this one. So we'll kind of add them a little bit in space, maybe repopulating the Earth somewhere or something like that. Kind of add some drama, a little bit of Game of Thrones type of drama between different fighting cultures and whatnot. So we'll do
So
something like
Christian
that.
Bale's like almost like that older king, and Florence Pugh is the
Exactly.
young princess who's going to rejuvenate
Exactly.
his
There you go,
lineage.
man. There you go. There you go. Exactly. Speaking of the fountain, am I right? But there you go. So there you go. So our what we're recommending to the audience is to be watching our movies, our Oscar-winning movies. There you go, and they'll be winning in succession order. So there you go. Thank you for watching another episode of Not a Strong Start. Please like, subscribe, comment, share on the YouTube channel, Not a Strong Start. You can listen to us anywhere, listen to your podcast. You can follow us on Instagram and Twitter, Not a Strong Start. I'm your host, the Inquisitor. You can follow me at King_Sangre.
I'm not your host. I want answers, damn it. You can find me at This Is Me No Bear on Instagram.
And I'm your other guy, the man with all the answers. And you can follow me at Nicolopolis.